So if there's anybody new here, URL for the course website over there. Delete that. All the good stuff's on it. If I haven't got your first assignment, no, just bring it up at the break or by the end of class. Okay. We were about here last class in a rather hurried attempt to get through sampling bias, and then I sent y'all a little email about that one. So let's just sort of flip through this again. So replication. Replication is actually really important in the sciences. It doesn't really matter what area of sciences, physics, chemistry, psychology, basket weaving. No, not basket weaving. Although there is an interesting sort of a, doesn't matter, different topic. No, replication is very important. You don't see this over in the arts so much. I mean, hey, I did a master's degree in history. You're not expected to, like, test out somebody else's, you know, interpretation of a historical event, do the whole paper over again. So it's a different approach. But in science, this is important. We replicate to find out whether or not you're actually going to get the same results. So if give the example of studying how chickadees here on the U of A campus make nests. Okay, so if somebody down at University of Calgary decides to check out how chickadees at the U of C make nests and finds that it's totally different than what's happening up here with the U of A chickadees, we've got something going on. Obviously, the U of A's got a better engineering program, so that would probably explain that. I don't know. Yay, go U of A. But if there's a difference, then you go, whoa, wait a sec, there's something else going on here. We can't generalize, or maybe there's been an error in the initial collection of the data, or maybe we've just got different populations that we're drawing from, these sorts of things. For example, not all rats are alike. I mean, a lot of people will go, oh, a rat, you know, it's, you know, got beady little eyes, scaly, ugly tail, how can they be different? There's different strains. Sprague Dawley rats, the sort of standard white albino lab rat, you know, they're pretty easygoing, kind of lazy, you know, they'll quite happily be carried around in your lab coat pocket, just going to go to sleep. You know, they're not necessarily going to be, I must get to the end of the maze. Long Evans rats, on the other hand, these are the so-called hooded rats, little sort of black fur over their head and shoulders, and then white body. I mean, these guys are, like, really driven, okay? They've got a high motivation drive, you know. I gotta see what's at the end of the maze. I don't know where it is. I gotta find it. They're also more likely to bite you. So, you know, there's differences there. If all you do in a study is say, we used rats, okay? So somebody tries, you know, does this initially with Sprague's, and then somebody else tries to replicate with Long Evans, and go, well, I'm not getting the same thing here. I'm going to step back and go, okay, why is that? Right? So replication is really important. Or if you do find the same answer, it's like, oh, okay, maybe the strain of rat doesn't matter all that much. Okay, so replication. It gives you the reliability. All right, now, sampling bias. Question on your first assignment about that one there. But basically, your population is the entire group that you're ultimately interested in. Maybe all the people in the world, maybe all the students in this class. We can define our population as whatever we're actually interested in. And the sample, then, is what you're actually working with. So it's a subset of the total population of interest. A sampling bias occurs when your sample is not representative. Okay, so if you don't have a representative sample, you could have a bias. I mean, you may not. You might just get lucky. But odds are you'll have some error in there, which means that your results may not be particularly reliable. You may not be able to generalize them to the broader population. Self-reports. Not the sort of thing that physicists or chemists or even geologists have to worry about terribly much. But anybody working in the behavioral sciences with humans and possibly the odd chimpanzee, but generally not, has to be concerned with this. Okay? People will lie about stuff. All right? They won't lie about everything. You know, did you have coffee this morning? Yes or no? Have you ever stolen anything? Have you ever cheated on an exam? Right? Self-reports can be distorted. If you are relying on subjects to give accounts of their behavior, you may not get an accurate one. I once had a conversation with a grad student in human ecology, so years back, and she had a really interesting study. We were talking about it. So she said, well, you know, you've heard maybe in more traditional societies, first sexual experience is like this rite of passage to adulthood. I said, yeah, I've read about this stuff, anthropology classes, yada, yada, yada. Okay. She says, well, I'm going to study that, but in, you know, an urban Canadian setting. So for urban Canadian youth, do they see first sexual experience as a rite of passage? It's like, okay, that's actually kind of a cool question to ask. How are you going to collect the data? Because being psychology and stuff, it's like, yeah, dealing with anything with sexual behavior is kind of a difficult one. If you ever read the very old introduction to the Haidt report, Cher Haidt talks about how difficult it was, this is going back in the 1970s, to actually trust the data she was getting from the questionnaire she sent out to like 100,000 odd Americans. So big sample size, but even still, will people lie? I said, okay, so how are you going to get the data from people? How are you doing this? And he said, I'll interview them one-on-one. It's like, and you don't think they're going to perhaps not tell you the complete truth about their sexual history? Well, it'll be anonymous, she said. No, it isn't. Well, I'm not going to tell anyone else, but you're going to know. It's not. Anonymous is like if they fill out a questionnaire and they have and you have no way of knowing who filled out what questionnaire. That's anonymous. And even there, people lie. It's like, well, why would they lie to me? Oh, I don't know. Let's say you've got, you know, your 19-year-old, you know, intro, whatever, psych or sociology or human ecology student in there, and you say, so, when was your first sexual experience? The person says, wow, I don't really want to tell her that I was 13 and it was in the back of a school bus. I'll come off looking somewhat trampish. I've never had sex. I'm a virgin. Okay. Contrast that with perhaps the 18-year-old male. When was your first experience? You know, it's like, oh, I can't tell her that I'm a virgin. I was 15. It was the band teacher. We did it on the drum. Boom, boom, boom. Really? You think people may not lie about something like that? It's like, okay. So this is a concern, right? Regardless of what you're doing, it's like if you're working with people and you're asking them to explain their own behaviors, I mean, even stuff that you think may be a fairly benign, like, have you had a cup of coffee today? If the person's doctor has said, you're drinking too much coffee, because maybe it's having something to do with a heart condition or who knows what, it's like they may not represent that correctly. So these are ones that you really have to think about. Okay. Not a big problem with rats. So did you press the lever earlier today to get a rat yummy? Squeak. Excellent. Not a big deal. Okay. Demand characteristics. Demand characteristics occur when the subjects in the study can figure out, or at least they think they figured out, what the purpose of the study is. Again, this is usually a problem with humans, not a problem with non-humans. All right? So if you've got a particular study going and the human participant thinks, oh, I think I know what the researcher is really trying to figure out here, I am going to mess with them just for the hell of it. Or because they want to know what my, you know, it's something about really, I don't know, political beliefs. I'm going to skew the data on them and make my party look better or worse or whatever. Now, whether or not the subject actually knows what the real purpose of the study is kind of immaterial. If they've gotten into a point where they think they know what it is, you might get into demand characteristics. Okay? Again, this comes back to, can you actually trust your data? Is it reliable? So that can become another issue there. Again, primarily an issue when working with humans. One of the great things about when I did my PhD with water striders was none of this stuff was really an issue at all. And frankly, if you had a water strider that just really wasn't working out for you, it's like, oops. experimental bias. Okay, now this one can apply regardless of area of science, whether you're working with humans, non-humans, leptons, hunk of quartz. Okay, experimental bias occurs when the researcher, either intentionally or more often unintentionally, is doing something that is going to cause misrepresentation in the results. Now, intentionally, this is what we call academic fraud. It's like, oh, you know, I've staked my reputation and career on getting this result, and my data doesn't support it. I will just change some numbers here until I get the outcome I need. That's very intentional. Unintentional might be the case where if you just, for example, had someone that's worked in the area for years and goes, oh, look, you know, looking at the data, this rat's behavior, it's way up here on the graph. You expect it to be down in this cluster. It's probably an outlier. I'm just going to remove that. Now, that may not be because the person's thinking, I've got to get, you know, my previous ideas confirmed. It may simply be an almost unconscious, I've seen so much rat data do this kind of thing before. There's just something weird going on with that one. Okay? Now, there's actually statistical techniques you can utilize to decide whether or not you should remove outlier data points. If you do that, then fine. But they take some time to do, and you know, if you've got people that are very experienced, they might just go, oh, that's going to be an outlier. Whether it is or not, we don't know at this point. Okay. So there could be bias there. Okay. Single, double, and triple blind studies. This has nothing to do with being visually impaired. In a single blind study, the subjects do not know whether or not they are in the experimental or the control group. If you tell somebody, we're going to give you the experimental drug, then whether or not that drug actually has any effect, they may behave as if it does. It's called a placebo effect. Okay? If they don't know whether they're in the experimental or control group, then hopefully there's not going to be any of this placebo effect going on. A double-blind study, neither the subjects nor the researcher who is carrying out the study can tell whether or not, at the time of, say, doing the treatment, whether or not he or she is giving the subjects the experimental or control procedure. Okay, so that's a double blind. Triple blind, neither the subjects nor the person carrying out the data collection nor the person analyzing the data knows whether the subjects are coming from the experimental or control group. Okay. Now, triple-blind studies are ideal. I mean, that's ultimately what you'd really like to get. The problem is, you now have to have lots of people. You have to have a fourth person that's keeping track of everything and knows which subjects were in which group and which data goes to which group and all this. So you've got to have a fourth person overseeing the whole system. This means you've got to have, you really have to have like a lab group at some point doing this. This is going to cost a lot more. A lot of research is done by just individuals, an individual researcher, or maybe one or two people. So this gets progressively more difficult, gets progressively more time-consuming, it becomes more expensive. Okay, so while triple-blind studies are brilliant, you don't see them too often. At minimum, you should always be seeing a single-blind, where, you know, in an experimental design, the subjects don't know whether they're in the experimental or control group. And it would be lovely if you can have a double-blind. I mentioned placebo effects in reference to this. Here's an example. A study from not too long ago that made a bit of splash. You may have heard of this or maybe not. I'm not sure. Mithoffer, a couple of years back, working with patients that have experienced post-traumatic stress due to serving in combat roles or law enforcement, so these sorts of environments. In particular, they were working with patients that were resistant to the therapies involved. So even after lots of therapy, their post-traumatic stress disorder was not getting any better. Here's what they did. They gave two exposure sessions. Okay, so two sessions of therapy. And before the therapy session began, subjects were either given some MDMA or a placebo. So an MDMA injection or just a saline injection. Who knows what MDMA is? Yeah. Yeah? Yeah, it's ecstasy. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. So go to therapy, get some ecstasy. All right. 2 months later, after this, they come back and check out using a behavioral measure, the degree of post-traumatic stress disorder experienced by their subjects. They find that less than 17% of the subjects in the MDMA or ecstasy condition are experiencing post-traumatic stress, but 75% of the placebo group is still experiencing post-traumatic stress. So how is this possibly working? Well, that's kind of the $64,000 question, and we're not entirely sure at this point. But one hypothesis, which is going to require further research, is that possibly what's happening here is the MDMA allows exposure theory to work a little bit easier. So the idea with exposure therapy is that the subjects have to relive the traumatic experience. So through discussion or through presentation of video or audio, whatnot. But generally, they're going to talk their way through the traumatic thing that happened to them. And so by doing this, they're essentially reducing the trauma. They're experiencing it. Nothing deleterious happens to them during the exposure session. Okay. So what's been proposed here is that post-traumatic stress disorder, I don't love the terminology, but quote unquote, narrows the window. In other words, it's like if you've got post-traumatic stress disorder, it's harder for you to actually discuss these traumatic things that have happened. Neurochemically, neurobiologically, your brain's just not going to process the information. The stress response begins, and during stressful situations, we know data intake is kind of poor. That's why you probably shouldn't be studying for exams if you're hyper-stressed out. Of course, one would argue that perhaps the final exam is what is, in fact, stressing you out. So we get this kind of circular problem going on here. So start studying early, okay? Ecstasy, perhaps, to use their terminology, opens the window a bit further. In other words, reduces the stress load, allows you to be open to experiences, removes inhibitions. Therefore, the patients can stay engaged during the exposure therapy. They can listen to what they're saying. They can listen to other people, perhaps in a group setting, or to the therapist. Okay, and use this to try to work through the traumatic experiences. Just at this point, a hypothesis as to how it may be working, but it's interesting. So again, what we've got here is a placebo that's put in place. So this is at least a single blind study. The subjects don't know, the patients don't know whether they are in the experimental or the control group. They don't know whether they're getting the ecstasy or getting just the saline solution. Models. Hey, there's a model. There's another model. That's a model, too. Model of human. That's a model car. Oh, hey, we saw that model on screen. That's a model we're going to encounter in a few weeks. These are all various types of models. All a model is a representation of reality. That's it. So the Barbie doll there, you say, yeah, person. Well, not a real person, obviously. And even if you could somehow gazappa turn Barbie into an actual biological entity, the legs would come up to here. And it's proportionately, this is not a real person. But nobody has a problem saying, this is a human doll. It's a human representation. Is it lifelike? No, but nobody has a problem categorizing it as a human. No one says, that's probably a giraffe. Some people might say it's just a travesty of justice that is indoctrinating young girls into negative self-body, but that's a whole different issue. We can at least, if it wasn't at least a model of human, we wouldn't have the travesty of injustice indoctrinating young girls into negative body images. Okay, so I mean, you see how these go together. The car, you know, the model car there. Anyone build plastic car kits as a kid? No. Do any of you remember what? Any of you ever seen a plastic car kit, or is it just all? Yeah, I built one on my iMac the other week. Yeah. Look, a model car, it's like a, you know, 1-to-4 scale model. If you actually have a 1-to-1 scale model of a car, you've got a car. It's no longer a model at that point, all right? Okay, so a model is just a representation of this real thing. They're analogies. They don't have to be real. And they don't have to be perfect. So the little one we did with, that was from Kinesis, over there, right? Where I generated a very simple random number generator to use a computer program to step this little triangle through things that would look very much like what actual kinesis movement patterns would look like in like a woodlouse or something like that. It's not real. The actual biological critter that this behavior is comparable to is obviously more complex. There's other things going on. But it does a lovely job of demonstrating the kinesis behavior that we're interested in. Okay, so it's not doesn't have to be the real thing. What models need to be able to do is allow you to make predictions. Okay, so they allow you to make hopefully fairly accurate predictions. Weather. Anyone ever check weather forecasts? None of you. None of you at all. I don't believe you. See, this is the problem with self-report. Okay, people just go, I'm not answering that. You've probably checked a weather report at some point. They're using models. Meteorologists use models to predict the weather. And they are correct to a greater or lesser degree, right? Usually predictions for, you know, 1 or 2 days. Usually pretty good. The models are pretty good there. You know, once you get into your 2-week prediction, you might as well probably just throw a, you know, dart at the board and see what you're going to get, because all kinds of other random factors and variables can come into play here. All right, this is why weather forecasts keep getting refined as you get closer to the date. But they are models. They are modeling what they think the weather is going to be. The actual weather is the weather. Okay. You ever hear these on the weather forecast? You know, 60% chance of rain. Look outside, it's raining. It's like, I think that's a 100% chance of precipitation right now. It's like, well, they're going off their model. Right? The model says, well, you know, over the course of the afternoon, there's a 60% chance that, there you go. It actually is raining, so the model was actually correct, but you know, at the time, it just seems a little bit peculiar. Okay. One of the things in science that we use models for is the generation of new ideas and the testing of hypotheses. So one can... And we'll see when we get into some of the classical conditioning work. We'll talk about something called the Skorla-Wagner model. And this is a mathematical model designed to make predictions about how animals, including humans, would acquire classical conditioning learning. And based upon this mathematical model, they actually made predictions for behaviors that could be identified and found, and then they subsequently went out and did the experiments and actually got that. It had never actually previously been reported in the literature. And I mean, this was happening in the 1960s. People have been researching classical conditioning since 1900. So over the previous 60 years, nobody had actually reported this. The model makes a prediction. The researchers go, Skorla and Wagner go, we should go test that in the lab. And sure enough, they actually get that result. Okay. So this is where models are useful. We will be encountering them as we continue on. The B1 divided by B1 plus B2 equals R1 divided by R1 plus R2 is involved in choice. So we'll see this is called a matching law later on in the course. Now, if we've got all these wonderful models that we can do, why do we need to actually bother using animal research? Why use animal subjects, including humans, for that matter? Okay. What we're working in here, so this course in learning behavior, is drawing its roots out of what was called comparative psychology. So we go back in time. People worked with rats and pigeons and dogs and cats and chickens and whatnot, not because they were particularly, the psychologists weren't really all that interested in how rats and pigeons and chickens and dogs, how their brains actually worked. They were using these non-human animals as models for human behavior for various reasons. It was easier to work with them. It was easier to house them. You put more controls in place. Okay, so all these things that could be done, and then you could go check it with humans. I think I've mentioned video lottery machines a couple of times. Probably, you know, somewhat unethical for us just to get a whole bunch of humans intentionally addicted to these things just to find out whether or not we can reduce that that behavior. First thing we have to do is get you hooked on crack. Then we're going to see if we can get you, oh, it didn't work. Oh, well, at least you still got the crack. Now, okay, so there's a problem with things like that. Same problem. Well, we got you addicted to gambling. We think we've got a therapy that, oh, it didn't work. Here's $50. Go have fun. No, but, you know, this isn't such a problem, ethically, if we get, say, a rat, quote-unquote, addicted to pressing the lever to get chocolate M&Ms, you know, and then it's like, oh, what do you know? We couldn't break the rat of his M&M fixation. Oh, well, you know, life goes on. We can set him up in a little cage with M&Ms for the rest of his life for, you know, $20. It's not that bad. Okay, so it'd be nice to test that before we start trying to bring therapies into effect with humans. Right? Okay, so this was the idea of comparative psychology. Try to understand human behavior by using non-human models. Obviously, humans do certain things differently than the non-humans. They have a hard time getting a rat to drive a car, or even a chimpanzee to drive a car, right? So obviously, there are differences. But the basics of learning are fairly similar. They generally cut across species to some degree. The non-humans are a simplified system. In fact, you know, we've talked about some of these issues in terms of demand characteristics, or you know, trying to think, well, what's going on in the study? Language, linguistics. The fact that we are a language-using species makes things sometimes more difficult. Okay, you give adults, first-year psych students, whatever, some task where basically they just have to press a lever, and you know they'll get reinforcers, points, or whatever on some kind of payout schedule. And you ask them what's going on, and you get all kinds of, we'll come back to this in a while, but you get all kinds of explanations, some of them stunningly complicated, right? It seems the better you get at language, the more experience you get with the world, the more you think that there's actually some complicated conspiracy going on, right? You give the same task to like a three-year-old kid who, you know, can talk, but you know, their language skills aren't up there. It's like, what's happening? Press the lever fast, I get more. Yeah, that's basically it. You know, the adults, well, I thought it was based on rate, but then I realized every time the clock went beep in the other room, about that point, I would get reinforced. Then I thought it was just based on the clock, but then I noticed it depended where I was sitting in the chair. Yes, that's it exactly. Very good. Well done. Thank you. Next. Let you go. Okay. So you don't worry about that with the non-humans. Like I said, you know, rat doesn't have a lot in the way of demand characteristics to worry about. I get rat food? Of course I'll do this study. No problem. All right. I mentioned ethics, right? There's just some things you probably shouldn't do with people to begin with. But there are some other things that are worth considering. The relevance of various features. Different species have different sensory capacities. You have to take that into account. All right. So dogs are colorblind. They're not. Well, they are, but they can. They see colors, just not quite the way we do. So you know, a dog may not be the best subject to test on, say, you know, the performance of a high definition television, right? Because it's missing one of the color ranges there. It's like, ooh, it's not that exciting. Okay. So you have to take these things into account. You have to think whether or not the subject you're using is actually appropriate. Rats and pigeons actually use landmarks differently for navigation. If you're trying to learn something about the way humans navigate, pigeons are actually a bit of a better model to use than rats. Okay? Unless possibly you're dealing with people that are visually impaired, in which case, because rats rely on vision less than pigeons do, they may actually be a better model. So these are things that one needs to consider when doing non-human animal research. So know the differences between your species. There's other things here. You may say, why is it that we seem to use rats, pigeons, mice, and gerbils so frequently nowadays in psychology? These are kind of the four primary animals that are non-human animals that are used in modern psychology studies. Why just those four? Partially just because we've been using them for a really long time. I mean, if you want to go off and do some study about learning with, I don't know, a hippopotamus or a wombat, great. You know, sort of my biology background in me says, that's super. I'd love to know how a wombat, you know, does in terms of operant conditioning. But, I mean, I don't know if a wombat has color vision or what the auditory range of a wombat is, or how rapidly it fatigues. So before you can actually, it's like, well, we presented a stimulus to the wombat and it learned nothing. Is that because it can't learn the operant conditioning protocol, or is it because you presented it with a color that it can't actually see? Not sure. Don't know. We know what rats can see. We know the audio frequencies, auditory frequencies that rats can hear. We're pretty well set on knowing what their sort of tactile abilities are. If you want to do some studies, like I'm going to use this visual stimulus, you can go back into the literature and see whether or not they can actually detect that stimulus. If you're using a completely new species, you got to do some background perceptual work first. Okay? And you may not have the time, money, funds to do that. So knowing your species is important. Houseflies. Ever wondered why it's so hard to actually smack a housefly? No, apparently not. Okay. Well, you know, if you ever tried this, it may not be easy to do, unless you're the guy from Karate Kid that catches them with chopsticks, that sort of thing. Our visual refresh rate is about 30 frames a second. So our eyes essentially take another picture of the world every 30th of a second, put these together, and it looks like we're seeing constant movie, if you will. If you've ever seen old black and white films, Charlie Chaplin films and whatnot, they sometimes seem a little jerky. That's because the film was being hand cranked through the camera for exposure, and sometimes the camera operator slowed down a little bit, or then sped up a little bit if the director yelled, hey! So you get that kind of problem. Okay. Flies see at their visual refresh rate is about 200 frames a second. From the fly's point of view, we move in slow motion. So the fly is sitting there, and suddenly from the flies, it's kind of like a Matrix thing, right? You know, in bullet time, suddenly it's... The fly's like, oh, yeah, hand's coming. Yeah, I'm going to finish eating this thing. Yeah, I guess I should go now. Oh, I almost had it. No, you didn't. You were nowhere close. You know, you got to come in from multiple sides or something like that, or just shoot it from a distance. Yeah. Okay, so difference there. Right? You need to, you know, depending on the visual, pigeons have a visual refresh rate to about 45 frames a second. In the old days, when you'd present visual stimuli to a pigeon, you'd use things like slide projectors. So you just present a static image up on the screen. Nowadays, what's commonly done is we use a computer screen. Computer screens are designed for people. So it's like, I'm showing the pigeon a solid red square on the screen. No, you're not. You're using a computer screen designed for people. What you're actually showing the pigeon is a blinking red square. Does that matter? I don't know. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. In fact, if you work with pigeons and want to use computer screens, you can actually, from scientific supply companies, buy screens that will visually refresh at higher or lower rates. So you can set these up. But that's the kind of thing one should perhaps be aware of. Whenever doing any sorts of studies as well, you get into issues of theoretical versus practical knowledge. This is often more an issue that you get into once you involve, say, funding agencies or governments or public watchdogs. You know, what's the point of doing this? It's like, well, it's a theoretical study. It will advance the theory. But how will that actually help us treat fetal alcohol syndrome? Or how will this actually lead to better design of roads through a city to reduce congestion? It's like, right now, it may not, but it could be foundational. So 20 years down the road, we're able to say, our money needs to go into something applied right now. You can't get to the applied stuff until you got a theoretical base to build on. So these become interesting issues. These often become issues more for sort of public management debates. So researchers often get kind of stuck in the middle on them. Back in the late 80s, I remember this, back in the 80s, when issues of HIV and AIDS first kind of reached public awareness, frankly, people were just jumping on the bandwagon saying, you know what, if you can put the words AIDS anywhere in your research protocol proposal, you'll probably get funding. Even if it was a stunningly tenuous link or connection, right? The Harper government has decided that Canada needs to do more applied research, economic potential. And as such, they're cutting funding to more theoretically driven things, like understanding, say, for example, global warming, because that doesn't necessarily have a really applied set of things. It doesn't let you control the weather. It may tell you whether things are going to get better or worse in the future, at least, but anyhow. So those are interesting issues, too. Ethical use of animals in computer simulations. Talked about this here. You get a lot of groups that are concerned about the use of non-human animals in laboratory studies. Fair enough. I have no problem with that. One of the things that many of these groups don't actually realize is that modern research universities have extremely stringent and strict ethical regulations on what you can do with your non-human subjects. Matter of fact, there's a whole bunch of things you can't do. I had a friend who was a grad student. She was interested in the hunting behavior of saut owls. Saut owls are owls about like this big. And basically it's like, we'll use mice, the natural food of saut owls, and we'll observe how the saut owls manage to capture the mice under different sorts of conditions. And her work was rejected. Initially, didn't get through ethics because, well, this is cruel to the mice. Mice are being killed. It's what owls do to mice. In the wild, yes, but not under controlled laboratory conditions. So basically, her research would have been fine if she went out into the woods and had no controls in place and just hopefully watched owls catch mice. But she was having problems if the owls were doing this in a laboratory condition. This is why, I mean, some of that seems a little bit silly. And the flip side is like, well, it may be cruel to the mice, but it's really nice for the owls. They get fed. So you get into some interesting things here. Okay. Anyways, leaving that aside, researchers here, for example, at the U of A, there's a body that regulates ethical treatment for all research animals in Canada. They can just randomly show up at your lab and demand to see your subjects at any time. You really don't have any warning. You just come knocking. And if there are issues, they will shut you down. If you do not resolve the issues quickly, you basically, well, pretty much your career working with non-human research subjects is done, because you won't be able to get grants in the future, which pretty much closes things off right there. Look, it's in researchers' best interests to actually take good care of their subjects. Why? Because if you've got non-human subjects, if you're working with rats and your rats are ill or malnourished or whatnot, you're not getting accurate results. The validity of your study is questioned. which again means you probably won't get published. Okay, so there are a lot of regulations in place, and from a self-interest perspective, really, you know, researchers want their subjects to be as healthy as they possibly can. Does this mean that we do not sometimes sacrifice animals to, you know, examine their brains or other tissues or whatever? Yeah, we do that. But over the last 20 years, there's been a move to try to reduce the number of subjects this is done with. So, despite working with water striders, I have done things with rats. And, I mean, what happens is people within, like, for example, here at the psych department at the U of A, somebody will get 20 rats for a study, they'll do the study with them, and then they'll send out an email to the other people in the department. It's like, okay, I've got 20 rats. Does anyone need them? They've gone through a maze learning study. And somebody might say, okay, sure. No, actually, I wouldn't mind using those 20 rats for a perception study. Okay, and so then they'll go through a perception study. And then say, okay, done with the perception study. I've got, you know, 20 rats. They've gone through a learning study, or a maze learning study, a perception study. They're now 6.5 months old. Does anybody else need them? And so by doing this, you may get 3 or 4 research runs out of the same 20 animals as opposed to needing 80 or 100 animals. Okay, so we are reducing the number of subjects that are being used. Some people say, well, why don't you just use computer simulations? Hey, Snyder, you talked about how models are great. Why don't we just model everything? Because models are only as good. Computer simulations are only as good as the data we can put into them. Right? You can develop a great model based upon current knowledge, but it's hard to go beyond that. So you can make some predictions based upon that, but how do you go another prediction? How do you take it another? At some point, you have to go and actually collect the data from the real organisms and then come back and rework, revise your simulation. There's a lovely simulation out there called Sniffy the Virtual Rat. Great teaching tool. But at some points, its behavior is not actually. It's a little rat, shows up on a screen, okay? A little computer, white rat, runs around, does a lot of the things rats do. You can press a lever, you can train it to make responses and do things. A few things it doesn't do. It doesn't poop, doesn't pee, you know? Doesn't just spontaneously go to sleep, wake up 4 hours later and get bored with whatever it was doing. You know, so all kinds of stuff that's not actually built into the simulation. Again, models, simulations, they're only approximations of reality. All right. Thus endeth chapter 2. That's not what I want. I want this. So we've gotten through background in the field. We've gotten through some methodological stuff. We're now going to get into classical conditioning. So we've talked about habituation and sensitization. We've talked about reflexes. These are actually significant because classical conditioning, also called Pavlovian conditioning, deals with learning that modifies or adds reflexive-like behaviors. Goes back to this guy. Ivan Petrovich Pavlov. You do not need to know when he lived or died. I have a master's in history. I feel somewhat conditioned, if you will, and thereby compelled to include dates, but I will not ask you something like, when did Pavlov die on an exam? A long time ago. Good enough. If you go Pavlov who, then we have a problem. Okay, something's called classical or sometimes also Pavlovian conditioning or learning. Pavlov was not a psychologist. The kinds of people that we think about as psychologists, you know, Sigmund Freud, Pavlov, they weren't psychologists. They were doctors. Pavlov was, his training was in medical physiology. He got sort of tired of actually treating people, and his real interest was in research, physiological research. And the thing that he decided to focus on was digestion. Pavlov was an extremely meticulous guy. Good thing. in a researcher. So he said, I'm interested in digestion. I will start at the beginning. So he will start when you put food in the mouth. And then his plan, his many-year research plan, was to then follow the food as it went all the way through the body and out the end. He would thereby have a complete, he thought, understanding of the human digestive process. So he starts out with this. And he's interested initially with salivation. That's pretty much up in the mouth. Put food in the mouth, salivary glands release saliva, and this helps to break the food down. So this is where he starts. So he wants to know things like how much saliva is produced under different conditions. Is there any chemical differences in saliva depending upon what food the animal is eating? These sorts of things. He initially works with dogs. So here's a model of a dog at the Pavlov Museum in Russia. There, it may be a little bit difficult to see here, but what they've done is they've surgically implanted a cannula, it's a little shunt, into the salivary ducts of the dog. So instead of having the saliva go into the mouth, the saliva drips through the shunt, through a little tube, and then there's a little vial. This is a little glass vial here. Drip, 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 drip into the vial, and you can measure six milliliters of saliva. Okay. Some people say this may be, this seems terribly cruel to do this to Fido. From everything we can tell, Pavlov and his lab took actually remarkably good care of the dogs. Aside from the surgical procedure, putting the shunt into the salivary glands, they named them. Most researchers now don't name their animals, right? Because you may eventually be dissecting them, right? So, it's just like rat 6, right? But he gave them all names. And we actually have the records of this, their own names. And there's pictures of most of the dogs they worked with actually out in a garden, various pictures of the dogs running around and hanging out. So, they weren't kept in small cages all the time. They just periodically had to, and it's not that bad for a dog. Periodically, you have to chew some food. Anyone have dogs? Yeah, that's like, I like food. This is great. Okay, so, not the most difficult thing here. So this is what they're doing. They're putting food in the dog's mouth. The typical food they used was they take meat, they'd dry it like into a jerky, then they grind it up and they make it basically a meat powder. So you can very precisely measure and weigh how much meat powder was going in. By doing it this way, grinding it, mixing up the powder, you had a fairly even mix of proteins and fats and everything else. So it wasn't like, oh no, we just gave that dog a really fatty piece of, jerky gristle, whereas this one just had a protein piece. So it's all fairly homogenized, so very, very nicely done. The way this seems to have worked was, and Pavlov, to be fair, Pavlov didn't actually carry out most of the studies himself. He had assistants that would do the dirty work of, measuring dog spit. Okay. One day, one of his assistants comes to him and says, Dr. Pavlov, I'm very sorry, but I need a different dog. Mine's broken. What did you do to the dog? Pavlov's concerned. He's like, well, it's not broken, but I think the dog wants to eat me. What do you mean? It's like, well, so, normally, put the powdered meat into the dog's mouth, wait, drip, 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 collect the saliva. But now, whenever I walk up to the dog, it starts salivating. I think the dog wants to eat me. I'm afraid of the dog. To Pavlov's credit, he could have said, okay, fine, just go get another dog. Instead, he said, show me. Show me what's going on. So he watches. Okay, so does he only do this when you're carrying the meat powder with you? It's like, no, anytime I, come into work, get my lab coat on, I go get the dog, get him from his kennel, he salivates. I put him in the room, attach him to its tether there in the room, he sits on the table, I come back, he salivates, and he keeps looking at me. He says, show me. And sure enough, lab tech does this, and yeah, drip, 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 drip into the vial. Goes fine. Says, that's interesting. Are you the only lab assistant that works with this dog? He says, yeah, I'm the only one. So Go get me another lab assistant. You know, find Yergi. I don't know. Whoever. Making up Russian-sounding names, okay? So, sure enough, he comes in and says, okay, just, have you ever worked with this dog? No, Dr. Pavlov. He's like, okay, walk up to the dog. Drip, 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 drip. That's interesting. Pavlov walks up to the dog. Nothing. Goes back. So he says, okay, let's try a variety of things. What if two of you go up at the same time? So the two lab assistants go drip, 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 drip. I mean, they try various stuff. After a while, it's like, okay, get me a clothesline, a coat hanger, and your lab coat. So it does that, puts the lab coat onto the coat hanger, and on a clothesline, sends the lab coat out towards the dog, salivates. It's like, oh, the dog doesn't want to eat you, he wants to eat the lab coat. No. Pavlov realizes what's happened here is that the dog has made an association. Now, Pavlov doesn't wear the lab coat. He's the doctor. He wears, you know, dark suits like this sort of thing. He realizes what's happened is a lab assistant. How do you know it's a lab assistant? How do you know it's a minion of science? Lab coat, okay? It's a good minion uniform for us. Okay, so lab coat. So every time the dogs get fed with this meat powder, they're being fed by somebody in a lab coat. The dog has come to make an association. Lab coat means food. What do you do before you get food? You start to salivate a bit. Now, he could have simply said, that's messed up, because I need the dogs that only salivate when the food goes in the mouth. So he could have said, yeah, get rid of the dog and go get another one. But he said, we should try to figure this out, because this is kind of, we didn't say cool, but whatever he would have said back, this is cool. We've got something going on here. And so he said, the salivation is a reflex. You know, the release of saliva through the salivary glands, that's a reflexive action. Put food in the mouth, boop, you will salivate, right? You can try this, you know, party tricks, you know, bet some friend of yours at the party, you know, I bet you I can make you salivate. No, you can't. Yes, I can. No, you can't. Put some money down. Okay, I got a 10 spot on it. Fine. Okay, open your mouth. Blech. Put a drop of lemon juice on the tongue. They will salivate. It's a reflex. Okay? Pretty much can't control that one. What's happening here is Pavlov says, a new type of reflex has been, well, actually he said it's a conditional reflex. But when his work got translated into English, they mistranslated it and became a conditioned ED. So conditioned reflex. I don't care. Either way, conditional or conditioned reflexes. There's been learning involved. A reflex is being produced through a learned response towards something that doesn't naturally produce the reflex. I mean, if you show a lab coat to a dog that has never gone through this procedure, it's just going to go, yelp. Do you want me to bite it? Are we going to play tug? What are we doing? Everybody's not going to salivate. It only happens with experienced dogs that have learned guy in lab coat means food. Lab coat, food. Okay. So, here's some terminology for classical conditioning. This is, I hope, a bit of a review from your intro psych, but I recognize that you probably did that some time ago. And stuff goes in, stuff comes out. So, real quickly here. Unconditional stimulus, US. This is the stimulus that produces the innate reflex. So, for example, food. Okay. If it was with, say, an eye blink reflex that we talked about, poof of air to the eye. Okay? That's your US. Unconditional stimulus. Unconditional response. This is the actual reflex action that occurs in response to the unconditional stimulus. So you present the unconditional stimulus, boop, you're going to get that reflexive response. Okay. Stimulus response. Okay, this is the innate thing. This is the innate reflex that's been produced through evolutionary selection processes. Okay, nothing new here. These are the reflexes we talked about last week. Here's where we get into the new stuff. The conditional stimulus and the conditional response. Conditional stimulus, I abbreviated CS, conditional response, CR. A conditional stimulus is any stimulus that, let's just for now say, doesn't originally produce an unconditional response. Usually the way it works. Okay, so we've got something, some stimulus, oh, you can leave your straw hat there, or my glasses, or a blinking red light, or whatever, that doesn't produce the unconditional response. Okay? So could be a bell. In classic Pavlov stories, they started using things like bells, so they'd ring the bell, give the dog food, that sort of thing. So, for example, a bell. The conditional response, then, is the action that is produced in response to the conditional stimulus. So, for example, salivation. Okay, the lab coat became the conditional stimulus. Salivation is the conditional response to the lab coat. Okay, so unconditional stimulus, unconditional response, that's the reflex. Conditional stimulus, conditional response, that's what's being produced by learning. That's the association. One of the very interesting things about classical conditioning is that it can occur whether or not you are aware that you are being classically conditioned. Okay, this makes it very useful and applicable in all kinds of circumstances. So you may not know that you are being conditioned, and yet the conditioning, if done correctly, will generally still work. You may realize that someone is trying to condition you. I can tell you. We're going to try an eye blink study. Okay, I will direct a puff of air at your eye. We'll do this 10 times. I will make a little snap sound before I puff the air at your eye, and then we will test and just give you the snap sound and see whether or not you blink. Okay, I can tell you what's going on. And it'll generally still work. So whether you're aware of this or not, we can still produce conditional responses. This is all kinds of very interesting and useful therapeutic results. And of course, we'll subsequently going to talk a little bit about things like advertising and marketing. Very useful there. I know the commercial is trying to sell me something. I just can't help it. I really want to eat Cocoa Puffs or whatever it is. Okay. Now, as I said, the USUR. That's your innate reflex. This, again, just as a quick reminder, it's hardwired into you. Right? Your reflexes is a very stereotypic pattern of behavior. It can't be modified through habituation or sensitization here. But that's innate. And this is one of the things, if you are getting to the point where you're saying, is this classical conditioning or not? We'll subsequently talk about what's called operant conditioning. If you don't have a reflex, you don't have classical conditioning. There must be some point in here a reflex action. Might be a little bit removed, but as we'll come to see, we talk about higher order conditioning in a little bit, but there is going to be in there someplace a reflexive action. Right. So, classic example, bell and food. This is a sort of visual technique that's often used in comparative psychology to depict classical conditioning. So if the line is flat, no stimulus has been presented, nothing's happening. If the line goes up, stimulus is presented or some event has occurred. Okay? So let's say we're going to use a bell as our conditional stimulus. Ring-a-ring-a-ring-a-ring-a-ring. And we'll use food as our unconditional stimulus. And our unconditional response is going to be salivation. Time, this is just like a graph, so our time here reads from left to right. So nothing happens. We turn the bell on, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. And just before we turn the bell off, just before we stop ringing, we pop some food into our subject's mouth. So the food goes into the mouth. And you see there, we get some unconditional response. We get some salivation. Okay. Now, notice in this case here, what's happening is the salivation is not being caused due to the bell. Those little bars are trying to show you sort of time frame here. We're not getting salivation occurring during the presentation of the bell. Salivation occurs after the food has occurred. So there's our reflex. So we do a few trials of this, and now we find that after we've done 10 trials or so of this, now we're starting to get some salivation occurring when the bell is ringing. So if the bell's rung for 15 seconds, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, so on, might get some salivation occurring during that period. Then the food goes into the mouth and we get some more salivation. So the salivation that's occurring during the presentation of the bell This is our conditional response. So this isn't due to the food, this is due to learning. An association has been formed between our bell and the food. A neural thingy has happened such that our subject goes, oh yeah, that bell indicates food is coming. Okay. So, in classical conditioning, very broadly, we can divide things into two processes. We can talk about acquisition and extinction. Acquisition is that period in which we are causing the formation of, or the acquisition of, the acquiring of a conditional response. So this would be where we are pairing the conditional stimulus with our unconditional stimulus. Okay, so that's our acquisition phase. Well, we can just keep going with that forever if we really want to. Extinction occurs when we are no longer presenting the CS with the US. So we just present the conditional stimulus by its own, or on its own, so by itself. So if we just ring the bell and don't give any food, the first few times we do this, there'll still be some salivation to the bell, but if we keep doing this, we get into what's called an extinction process. The strength of the conditional response will gradually fade and probably entirely stop. Okay, so acquisition is the increase in strength of conditional response, extinction the decrease. Extinction results in the decrease in the strength of our conditional response. How do we go about measuring this? Well, Pavlov's technique was to work with salivation and put little cannulas into the cheeks and measure spit. Not always the easiest thing to do. It's tough to do that with rats or gerbils or mice, things like that. So there's various things we can do here, but leaving those actual details aside, it is often difficult to actually measure our conditional response. This may be because, so what if we're only presenting our conditional stimulus for, say, 2.5 seconds, and then our unconditional stimulus shows up? You might say, well, we just measure the amount of the conditional response during the CS there, but they're pretty close together in time. But let's even say we're dealing with salivation. It takes a little bit for the saliva to start going, so by the time our bell is kind of done, yeah, maybe there was some salivation beginning while the bell was going on, but it may merge into the salivation being produced by putting the food into our dog's mouth. So how can we tell? Okay, so this becomes a difficulty here, potentially. They may overlap. Various ways to do it. You can do what's called a test trial, sometimes called a probe trial. On a test trial or a probe trial, you just present the conditional stimulus by itself. So we do a whole bunch of CS paired with US. We do the CS, then we present the US. Now we're going to do a probe trial. We just present the conditional stimulus, we just ring the bell, and we see whether or not there's any conditional response. And you say, wait a minute. Isn't that putting the subject on to extinction? I know you're all thinking that, right? Good. It's like, yes, excellent, that's right. You are, in fact, putting the subject on to extinction. So isn't the conditional response going to start weakening? Yes, again, excellent, very well done, yes. Yes, it will. But this is why we only do like a probe trial very occasionally. You may only do one of these probe trials every 10 or 15 presentations of a CS-US pairing. So yes, you will get a little bit of extinction there, but then you go back to doing CS, the bell, and then the US, the food. So the extinction is pretty much reversed right then. We go back to it, okay? But if there's no unconditional stimulus, if there's any conditional response that's going to show up, it has to be due to the conditional stimulus. It has to be due to the CS. Okay. Second way of doing this is by measuring the intensity of the response. So we go through some baseline, present the unconditional stimulus, and see what the strength of the unconditional response is. Okay? So when we present 2 grams of food, we get 3 milliliters of saliva. Okay, we do that a number of times. We get a nice average. We think that's pretty consistent. Great. Now we're going to go through and do a bell, the CS paired with the US. We do this 15, 20 times. Now we're going to measure the amount of saliva that's produced, and here we get 5 milliliters. milliliters of saliva. So if we were getting 3 milliliters of saliva for 2 grams of food, we still got the same 2 grams of food, but now that we've added this bell in, we've got a conditional stimulus, we're getting more salivation. Okay? That additional saliva, the increase in salivation intensity, if you will, we presume, is due to the conditional stimulus. If that's the only other thing we've changed, that's what that additional salivation is coming from. Okay, so either test trials, or call probe trials, or measuring intensity. Some examples. We talked about eye blink with respect to reflexes. Okay, so puff of air towards the eye, blink, causes a blink. Now, we can do, as I said, snap of the finger, or if you've got a little buzzer, or something, anything at all, we do a little snap at the eye. Snap at the eye. Snap at the eye. And do this maybe 10 or 15 times. You can try this at home with your friends. Again, all you need is a straw and try not to spit. Because that's no fun for the person on the receiving end of this. Just a little puff of air. You can use a turkey baster if you want. Okay. Do not say, well, I figured I'd use the leaf blower. Point it at someone's face. Eye knock through the back of their head. No, gentle puff of air. Okay. So, what we find here is that, sure enough, you will probably, upon just, if you do a probe trial, snap the fingers, you will probably get your subject to blink. Interestingly enough, there's a few differences between, so that blink to the snap of the fingers, that would be your conditional response. There are a few interesting differences between the blink to the air puff and the blink to the snap of the fingers, though. The blink to the air puff, so the UR, the reflexive response, is usually, it's going to be very fast. It's a very quick response. It's very forceful, very quick. The conditional response, that is the blinking to the click of the fingers, is usually slower and not so forceful. It's just a closing of the eyelid. Okay, so longer, it's not as quick, and it's not quite as intense. As it turns out, there's actually a different underlying neural circuitry pattern that goes through this. The reflex is going through our reflex arc. Our conditional response is going through the brain. We talked about that last class. Okay, so, just to diagram this, so we've got a conditional stimulus. If you don't like snapping fingers, if you're no good at that, use a tone. The US is the air puff, so pair these together a bunch of times. You will, of course, get a blink with response to the US. And then after enough of these trials, you will start to get a blink with response to the conditional stimulus. Okay. Here's another one. And one that probably at least some of you have experienced, taste aversion. I'm not going to ask you what you are taste aversive to, but many university students encounter at least one alcohol at some point in their lives. Not all, that they can not always just one. Some university students encounter many that they can no longer drink. Well, I can't drink Jägermeister anymore, or tequila fanny bangers, or, there's that scotch. I can teach you how to avoid taste aversions. It's a proactive step, actually. Gradually expose yourself to a variety of alcohols in small amounts so you condition to the taste, and, don't go at it all in one big slam. Anyways, back to this. Taste aversion. They are very strong and extremely persistent. Okay. Often called one trial learning. There's not a lot of things that you can learn with classical conditioning in a single trial. Taste aversions are often that thing. So many people, they are being treated for cancer, they have chemotherapy, They eat something, you know, they go home after getting the chemo, they have dinner, they get violently ill due to the chemotherapy, and then they can no longer eat whatever that thing was that they had for dinner. They now feel nauseous when they even think about it or when they encounter it. Again, that's a taste aversion. If you go out and have, I don't know, monkey brain sushi, never had it before, so you say, oh, that's interesting, monkey brain sushi. What do you know? You can put almost anything on a little bed of rice. And then you are violently ill a few hours later. Whether or not that was due to the monkey brain sushi, could have been due to something else, but you get violently ill. Odds are you probably won't have a great desire to consume monkey brain sushi ever in the future. We can eventually work that out of you. You know, Dr. Snyder's patented technique for curing taste aversions, but it could be difficult and time-consuming. Okay, so here's a way we can do this under more controlled experimental conditions with rats. We take some rats and we feed them a novel food. Take and say flavor their food with anise. So basically make their food pellets taste kind of like black licorice. Okay, so let's assume this is something the rats have never experienced before. So they kind of they eat some of the new food. It tastes different. And then we you know, a few minutes later, pick up the rat, give it an injection of lithium chloride. Lithium chloride produces nausea in most mammals. Certainly works on rats. Okay, so you give them a little injection. It's not doing anything that's long-term damaging to them. It gives them a stomach ache. Now, you know, again, this is where, based, you go back in the literature, we know how much lithium chloride to give rats. So if you give them a certain amount, you know, they'll feel somewhat nauseous for maybe just 15, 20 minutes. I mean, if you give them a lot, they're going to feel pretty ill for hours and hours and hours. You don't want that. All we need here is to make them feel like they get a bit of a tummy upset for maybe 15 minutes. Rats are great to do this with because rats are what we call food xenophobic. Rats cannot vomit. I mean, dogs eat something and it's like, oh, not feeling, got a rumbly my tumbly, blah, they just throw it back up, you know. What did you eat? You ate my memory drive! Ah! You know, my cell phone, my, you know, dogs will eat all kinds of, I didn't know what it was, so I thought I'd eat it. How have you survived this long as a species? You know? Because I can vomit really fast. Right. Rats can't vomit. If they eat something poisonous, they'll either survive or it's just going to kill them. Okay? So they tend to be really leery about eating new foods. Matter of fact, if you present them with a new food, they may avoid it for a little while, and they may just take a few nibbles of it, and then they'll just kind of wait and see what happens. If they don't get sick, they'll probably go back and eat some more. If they do get sick, here's where we get into taste aversions. So we don't need to make them very sick at all. Okay, so they eat the new food. We'll call that our conditional stimulus. Then we give them the injection of lithium chloride. Lithium chloride, this drug, it's going to be our unconditional stimulus. It's going to produce the pain response, the nausea. Okay, we let that wear off, come back, say the next day, and we present the rats with a choice. They can have their new food, this licorice-flavored food, or their old food. And most of them, you know, 9 out of 10 rats, there's always one wacky one, 9 out of 10 rats will choose the old food. I have watched rats bury the novel food under wood chips. I've watched rats come up to the pile of new food and poop on top of it, or pee on it. It's like, do not eat this. It's worse than poop. So warning to other rats, do not consume things that taste like pee. So they will almost always go for the old food that's never made them sick in the past. So we've produced a taste aversion. And it wasn't even a lot of nausea. They're just feeling like an upset stomach for 15 minutes, kind of thing. And then they're back to doing all their little rat things, okay? So not a lot. Taste aversion. Like I said, many of you probably have your own story of taste aversions that you could detail and recount at great length. Anyhow. Now, I said before, anytime you deal with classical conditioning, you're going to have a reflex involved here. I said it's not always, you know, immediately obvious where that is. You may have to work your way back a little bit here. So what we've been talking about up to now is what we call first-order conditioning. So the CS is paired up with the US. We ring our bell, we put food in the mouth. CS, US. But once we've established a first-order conditioning, once we pair the CS with the US, we can take another stimulus and pair it with the CS. But we don't need the US. Okay? So our second conditional stimulus, in fact, we often abbreviate it this way, CS2, gets paired up with the CS1. It's the CS1 that was paired up with the US. So the subject in the brain makes an association. CS1 means food. CS1 means food, CS1 means food, CS1 means food. Then we go CS2, CS1, CS2, CS1, CS2, CS1. Oh, if CS1 means food, CS2 comes with CS1, CS2 also means food, even though the CS2 has never been directly associated with the unconditional stimulus. This can be very useful in things like dog training and whatnot. If, I mean, to train dogs to do stuff, dog trainers or people that are doing guide dogs and whatnot, or agility training or whatnot, police dogs, right? You can get them to do stuff by giving them little treats. But, you know, if you are only doing that, eventually you've got a very, very fat dog. So your police dog, you know, if you've just been doing this all by, you know, Scooby snacks, after a while, you know, you've got this hulking German Shepherd, which may look terrifying. But it's like, oh, geez, okay, you know what? If the criminal comes to me, I'll take him down. But seriously, I'm not chasing him for more than, can I get into the car, squad car, and we can do the siren thing? Because, yeah, okay. So a second order, or what we call higher order conditional stimulus, is useful. In things like dog training, we use clickers or whistles or things like that. Okay. Second order condition. So just to sort of graphically demonstrate this, let's say we've got a tone. So we're going to pair a tone with food. Okay, and we're going to call our tone here our CS1. And this is just what we've been talking about up till now. So tone paired with food, tone paired with food, tone paired with food. The food produces an unconditional response. And if we do this enough times here, now eventually if we do a probe trial, we'll find that our tone produces a conditional response. So we get some salivation here as well. Okay, so this is our first order conditioning, all right? Or basic classical conditioning, but it's called first order conditioning. So the tone is directly paired with, directly associated with our unconditional stimulus, CS and US. Now, second order conditioning and higher order conditioning, essentially the same thing, but I mean, if you had third order conditioning, that would be another type of higher order conditioning, fourth order conditioning, etc. Okay, so let's say we got a light. So now we're going to pair a light with our tone. Light, tone, light, tone, light, tone. And what we'll probably find is that after a number of trials, our light will produce a conditional response as well. It will produce some salivation. Again, the light has never been directly paired with the unconditional stimulus. But the tone has. Okay, so this is what we call it. This is second order, because it's the light here is, if you will, one order of magnitude removed from the CS1. And the CS1 is one step away from the US. So we've got two steps in here. Okay? Anything beyond first order conditioning is called higher order. So we could also get, like, I don't know, a little stimulus, a little buzzer. You can get collars that you can, they've got a little motor on them, they'll vibrate. Okay? People that train dogs for like duck hunting or distant things love these. Okay? Sometimes called shock collars, but you can set them just to like buzz a little bit. So we can have a vibration. So we can just pair the vibration stimulus with the light. Do that. Keep pairing the light with the tone, do that, and then we'll probably get a conditional response to the vibration. That would be third order. How high can you go?
Generally, third order is about what you're going to get into. There have been cases where you get up to fourth order, really hard to go beyond that. Okay, at some point, your connection to the U.S. is just getting too tenuous, too weak. So by the time we get up to like third order, the conditional response for our third order CS, our CS3, is probably getting weaker. It's not likely to be as strong as that for our conditional response to the CS2 or certainly the CS1. Okay. Now, one of the potential issues that we can get into is getting into a extinction. Right? So we say, okay, we've paired the CS1 with the US. We pair a tone with the US. Do a bunch of that. Now our tone produces a conditional response. If we go, that's lovely. Now, let's just do a whole bunch of light paired with tone. Light tone, light tone, light tone, light tone, light tone, light tone, and on and on and on and on, on like this. Every time we're presenting the tone without the US, we're experiencing a little bit of extinction. Oops. If the association between the tone and the US is being broken through extinction, then the conditional response is going to weaken to the tone, and consequently, our conditional response to the light may never actually establish, or it may extinguish out as well. So what you have to do is you have to periodically still do some CS1 US pairings. So if you want to use higher order conditioning here, so if we want to set up our light eventually as a CS through higher order conditioning, every now and then we have to present the CS1 with the US. Okay? As long as we've set the CS1 up with the US really well, we've established a good, strong conditional response initially, maybe we can do it a CS1 paired with the US every 3 or 4 trials. Okay, so it doesn't have to happen every time, maybe 3, 4, 5 sort of thing. Probably, you don't probably want to, every 5th at least sneak one in. Okay? So you have to keep the strength of the conditional response from the CS1 US pairing fairly strong. You want to avoid that extinction. If you don't, this is eventually just all going to peter out and you won't have conditional responses to anything. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. Right. So periodically we'll go back and do our first order conditioning there. There's more than one type of conditional stimulus. These are described as excitatory and inhibitory conditional stimuli. What I've been talking about up to now, they've all been excitatory conditional stimuli. We often abbreviate these by just going CS+. An inhibitory conditional stimulus is a CS-. Part of the reason that we just use mathematical signs is actually going back to Pavlov. So going back to the 1890s, 1895, when Pavlov was working on this, he thought of these as very much additive and subtractive processes. Okay, so that's why we just use mathematical notations, plus signs and minus signs. Okay, so CS+ is an excitatory conditional stimulus. An excitatory conditional stimulus says, in the presence of the CS, this CS predicts the occurrence of the US. If you are experiencing a CS+, this means you should expect the US to occur. This conditional stimulus means US will occur. All other things being equal, right? I mean, if you do a test trial, a probe trial, no, you're withholding at that time, but the expectation, right? The expectation is the CS has been paired with the presence of this unconditional stimulus. They go together. Okay. And then consequently, you would expect to get some sort of behavior related to the unconditional stimulus occurring to the CS. There's your conditional response. A CS minus, the inhibitory conditional stimulus, this one says that the CS is going to predict the non-occurrence of the unconditional stimulus. In the presence of this CS, the US will not occur. And Consequently, in the presence of CS minus, you will expect a suppression of behavior related to the unconditional stimulus. This isn't strictly a classical conditioning analogy. It's really more of an operant, but think about it like a traffic light, right? Green means go, red means stop, yellow means go really, really fast. Right? So, presence of green, that says you should be going. Red says I should be stopping. What's a police officer in the intersection with his hand out say? Light is green, police officer, got the hand out. Well, a police officer with a hand out, by analogy here, would be your CS minus. Right? Even though maybe there's a green light up on the traffic standard, cop saying, nope, don't go. And if you do, I've got a Glock, semi-automatic, and I'll pop a few caps into your car. Hopefully not, but you get the idea, right? Traffic control through force of arms. Okay, so again, this is more actually of an operant conditioning thing, but just use it sort of as an analogy there. You've got something that says, the police officer says, oh, I know you've got the green, you should be able to go, but I'm saying don't go. Okay, so the CS minus says, the U.S. is not going to occur. All right. So how are some different ways we can establish some CS minuses here? Pavlov did it this way. He would present a CS plus with the U.S. So boom, up here, line, nothing's happening. Boop, steps up. That means the CS is turned on, it's presented. And then the U.S. gets presented as well. We've got some other stimulus here, the CS minus, and on trial type A, it's just not turned on. Nothing happens. So on trial type A, you've got this conditional stimulus, the CS plus, and then the U.S. occurs. Trial type B, both our CS plus stimulus and our CS minus. So if the CS plus is a bell and our CS minus is going to be a light, in trial type A, just the bell is rung and then food is popped in the dog's mouth. On trial type B, the bell is rung and a light is shown at the dog. No food is delivered. So randomly, Pavlov or his laboratory minion would do a bunch of these trials, trial type A, trial type B. Okay, and over time, what the dog learns is, in the presence of the light, don't bother salivating because no food is coming. You're only getting food if you just have the bell. So the bell is a CS plus. Light's the CS minus. Okay. Another way you can do this is called a negative contingency protocol. In this case here, basically what you're doing is you're setting up a contingency in which you've got a conditional stimulus that never occurs in conjunction with the U.S. So at various points we present the U.S. Here you go, dog. Boop, food in the dog's mouth. Dog goes, whoop, salivates. And then at some point, boop, we shine the light on the dog. No food. Some time passes. Food is presented to the dog. At some point, we turn the light on again. Okay? So the light never occurs with the food. All right? So what's the dog learning? I get food sometimes, but the light... hey, in the presence of the light, I never get food. So it may not be just that, I only get light when there's... Or probably, I only get food when there's no light. It may even be learning, if the light's on, I definitely don't get food. No food. No food right before the light. And this is a random occurrence here, but no food. So our CS minus. Okay, so negative contingency protocols. Okay? So the idea here then is, in this case here, then if we also had a CS plus, if we'd done some CS plus conditioning, our CS minus now is serving as a... You might call it context cues. Okay, so in a particular context, if you've got a CS minus and a CS plus together, the might expect that they're kind of going to cancel each other out. And again, this is why Pavlov used these mathematical notations, that if you've got like plus 5 units and minus 5 units, plus 5 plus minus 5 gives you 0. Okay, so he thought these were very much like, remember, he's a medical physiologist. Now, back in the 1890s, they don't know a heck of a lot about how the brain is working. They know a little bit about excitatory and inhibitory neuronal states. So he says if you've got one part of the brain that's being excited by an excitatory conditional stimulus, then there's probably some other part of the brain, he was wrong on this, but there's some other chunk of brain that's then inhibiting this. If they are of equal strength, if the excitation is of equal strength to the inhibition, they will completely cancel out. You will not get a conditional response. So he used mathematical notation on this. And we just stick with that kind of terminology. All right. Let's finish this up, and then we'll take a break. Now, there's a couple of things about setting up inhibitory conditional stimuli. You really need to be able to test and figure out that you've actually got that. So look, the idea of a CS minus is the CS minus is producing no conditional response. How can you tell that's because you've actually learned something? So how can you tell the absence of a response is because the subject has learned this conditional stimulus says no US, as opposed to maybe the subject just hasn't learned anything at all?
What was that stimulus? I don't know. I wasn't paying any attention.
So the absence of something is kind of hard to test for. So that's the question. Is it because we've got a CS minus that action has been produced, or we just haven't learned anything at all? A couple of ways you can do this. Probably the easiest way is to use what's called a summation test. So we measure the strength of the conditional response in the presence of the CS plus, so we mean CS plus, and then we simply produce what's called a compound stimulus. So we present the CS plus along with the CS minus, and we measure the conditional response. If the conditional response is weaker, maybe it's nothing, maybe there's no conditional response at all, or maybe it's just a weaker conditional response, then we say, okay, yes, there has been some inhibition. If nothing was learned about the CS minus at all, if there was no learning, then this should have no effect on the strength of the conditional response in the presence of the CS plus. Okay, so if there is zero learning, you have 5 units of excitation, so plus 5 units of salivation. If nothing was learned, we've got goose egg, 0 units of inhibition, well, plus 5 plus 0 is still plus 5. There'd be no change. If we even have like 2 units of inhibition, plus 5 plus minus 2, 3 units at the end, so we'd have a little bit weaker conditional response. So that would indicate that we actually have produced a CS minus. Second way of doing this is called retardation of acquisition. So we go through our training. You can either do it in Pavlov's way or the non-contingent. So we train up what we hope is going to be a CS minus. And we've also got a novel stimulus here. Now we're going to pair both our CS minus then, we're going to shift. Essentially, we're going to now start pairing our CS minus with the US. Before we're doing training, you present the CS minus as no US. But now we're going to say, hey, we're changing things. Now we're going to pair it with the US. And we take our novel stimulus and we're going to pair it with a US as well. If our CS minus training actually produced something inhibitory, it should take longer, more trials, to get a conditional response of a particular strength in the CS minus than in our novel stimulus. Look at it this way. Again, think about it mathematically. If our CS minus is down at minus 5 units, okay, so 5 units of inhibition, and our neutral stimulus here is at 0, it takes X many trials to get up to plus 5 units of conditional response. Okay. Let's assume it takes 5 trials. Okay. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Our neutral stimulus is now giving us 5 units of excitation, so 5 units of conditional response. Our inhibitory conditional stimulus was down at minus 5. Plus 5 just takes us up to 0. It's going to take another 5 trials to get up to the same level as our neutral stimulus. Okay. So just try to think about it mathematically. That may, you know, number line, go back to grade two, put number lines down, think about it that way. Okay? What this is suggesting is if we do this retardation of acquisition, it says that the prior learning about our CS minus here is actually inhibiting the learning of a new association. You have to go, I've learned that this conditional stimulus means I don't get the U.S. Why am I getting the U.S. now? Something is weird. Something's going on. You have to unlearn what you've learned before so that you can start going, oh, no, wait, now this actually means I will get the unconditional stimulus. In essence, you have to extinguish your prior learning about what the CS minus means and now start learning it as a CS plus. That will take longer. Okay, let's take a break. Go on back in 10 minutes, so 16 past.